Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, Europe responds to the latest peace push in Ukraine with caution. We'll be looking at the EU's military mobility plans, as well as the emergence of drone startups as an increasingly important part of Europe's complicated security puzzle. All that plus a tribute to Sir Nicholas Winton, one of the key figures behind the Kindertransport, which saved thousands of Jewish children from the Nazi Holocaust during World War II. The first Kindertransport train left Berlin on the 1st of December 1938.
Unsere Nachrichtendienste sagen uns eindringlich.
Germany's Foreign Minister, Johann Wadephul, addressing the Berlin Foreign Policy Forum on Tuesday. He was warning that Russia is, quote, at least creating the option of a war against NATO by 2029. In so speaking, Germany's Foreign Minister reflected a widespread European fear that if peace in Ukraine is negotiated on Russia's terms, then Russia may use the time to regroup and come back bigger and stronger than before. And so, whilst cautiously welcoming the latest US-backed peace efforts, European leaders are keeping a wary eye to the future. Our Brussels-based security correspondent Terry Schultz reports on Europe's ongoing efforts to strengthen the ability of its forces to defend the front line.
The possible timeline within which Russia may try to strike Europe beyond Ukraine gets shorter all the time, with the German foreign minister's warning this could happen in less than 4 years, just the latest alarm. What's not changing fast is NATO's ability to move its tanks and troops to the front line as reinforcement after any such attack might happen. Bridges, roads, and tunnels are often simply impassable for heavy equipment. Bureaucracy and border procedures are bulky. EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas says bluntly, this situation is not acceptable.
It is quite simple. The faster we can move forces, the stronger our deterrence and defense. We need to be talking about days, not weeks, to move troops in Europe. 11 years after Russia annexed Crimea, this is simply not good enough.
The European Commission has identified 500 bottlenecks, and that's just the top priorities, which it's trying to address urgently in its new military mobility upgrade plan. By the end of 2027, the Commission wants the 27 member states to eliminate as much as possible the obstacles to quick movement of military forces. Instead of the current situation, in which at least one country has retained the right to take a month and a half to respond to a request for passage across its borders, new regulations would require that answer to come in 3 days during peacetime. In case of conflict, it wouldn't even be necessary to ask permission, just to notify of the transit. Transportation Commissioner Apostolos Tsitsikostas, one of four top officials who were concurrently on stage presenting the new plan, said this does not mean Europe necessarily believes conflict is coming.
So in the question, is Europe preparing for war? The answer is no. Europe is preparing for peace. Europe wants peace. But if we want peace, we need first to be ready for war.
European defense could have been more ready much earlier had EU and national leaders acted on the numerous reports over decades identifying these problems as well as their solutions. Mihai Chiaia with the European Policy Center is among the researchers who investigated and published repeatedly on the challenges and urgency of improving military mobility.
There is a bit of disconnect between the progress that has been done, of course, on paper, in policy documents, in strategies, which is good progress, but then in practice, we don't see that much.
Chiaia points out the infrastructure projects that need to be undertaken would require many years to finish, and most of them haven't even been started.
We have the strategies, we have the priorities to enhance military mobility, but then what is needed in the end is political will. And what we see, according to my opinion, is that the political will is not where it should be.
More than a decade ago, when U.S. Army General Ben Hodges was in charge of American forces in Europe, he was running into the same problems of red tape and restrictions as he was commanding multinational exercises with NATO forces. He recalls one memorable moment during an air jump exercise.
The Bulgarian Interior Ministry was going to require each paratrooper to show his passport after he landed because they had entered Bulgaria. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. How could this be? We've been working on this exercise for a year. Eventually, it got sorted. But I mean, that was the kind of thing that we encountered.
Back then, Hodges coined the term a military Schengen zone to call for harmonized transport plans across alliance territory, something that's still lacking.
We need the same effect that a truckload of apples could go from Poland all the way to Lisbon, Portugal without ever stopping because they could travel all the way through the Schengen zone. And I said, that's what we need for NATO forces, for military forces, to be able to move without stopping.
Now the commission is using the same term. Some countries have gone ahead and set up this kind of corridor. A group led by the Netherlands, Germany, and Poland has now been joined by five others, a model for the rest of the continent. While infrastructure upgrades will take many years, Mihai Chiaia says some improvements could be made immediately, like simply having conversations between ministries, armed forces, national and local authorities, and the private sector.
What we see is that these actors don't really cooperate together to enhance military mobility. In some cases, they don't even speak to each other.
The Commission's proposal for the EU's next seven-year budget, which is currently under negotiation, would allocate just over 17.5 billion euros to help member states start their upgrades. It's not a lot spread over 27 countries in 7 years, but it is 10 times more than the last budget contained. Ben Hodges will be watching closely to see how much is left when the budget is approved by both the European Council and the European Parliament.
If you're serious about something, you put money on it and you put people on it. If you don't put money on it or you don't put people on it, then you're not really serious.
He says Europe must be serious this time about ensuring its militaries can get to the front line, because Russia surely is serious about testing that itself. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Increasingly, European military readiness is bound up with its ability to respond to rapidly developing and often relatively cheap to manufacture technology such as drones. And the Ukrainian experience is showing that in this field, at least, smaller, more agile security tech startups are proving themselves capable of playing an increasingly significant role. Ben Batka was in Estonia's capital Tallinn to meet up with Ragnar Sass, a Estonian tech entrepreneur who has pivoted towards defence.
Okay, guys, it's a long drive. So the first rule is that you should always be sure that you're sharp enough and not sleeping on the wheel.
We had a case. It's just before dawn on a mild September morning somewhere on the outskirts of Tallinn. Estonian entrepreneur Ragnar Sass and a team of drivers are walking to a parking lot where around half a dozen trucks, painted black and khaki, are ready for departure.
Go.
The donated and retrofitted vehicles bear slogans like Ukraine defends everybody's freedom and orcs must die. The trunks are filled with drones, electronic warfare equipment, batteries, night vision cameras and mud tires. Among the more than 50 volunteers, including five women, driving the trucks to Kyiv this morning is Denis, the Ukrainian founder of a charity that builds drones for his country's armed forces.
The truck is an awesome addition to our military because trucks break regularly and so on.
How many hours will you be spending on the road?
Around 26. But
to Kyiv or?
To Kyiv, yes. But I have a co-driver who will switch and that's not a big problem.
I made a photo. I said, hey, today is Sunday, I bought a car and I will drive to Lviv next Friday.
Sass is the man behind the convoys. A few weeks into the war, the successful tech entrepreneur and investor spontaneously bought a Toyota pickup truck after a Ukrainian soldier asked him for help when his car broke down near Kharkiv, the 49-year-old tells me.
And I putting it out and it somehow went small scale viral. Some journalist called me. Some people said, how we can help you. Some said, how we can donate. Hey, I want to give my car.
In the 3.5 years since, over 40 convoys consisting of almost 800 pickup trucks have delivered 17 million euros worth of tailor-made aid and military equipment, including over 2,300 drones, according to SAS, directly from Estonia to Ukrainian frontline units.
Safe travels. Okay.
Thank you.
SAS believes civil society-driven efforts like fundraisers, in combination with decentralized procurement, have been critical for Ukraine's survival, as they have allowed the military to adapt much quicker to the rapid evolution of the battlefield. Ukrainian brigades, for instance, can order drones and other weapons from two online marketplaces, using either privately raised or state money as they see fit. Oksana Ferchuk, Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Defense for Digital Transformation, explained the advantages of decentralized procurement at the Tallinn Digital Summit last month.
The technology on the front line is changing every 2-3 weeks. You just cannot afford it because the products you are buying, if you deliver in within a year, you will not have a military unit to supply to. The supply time now we see is 10 days.
One of the ways Estonia is reacting to this trend is by embedding civilian technology officers with domestic battalions to not only identify and solve problems based on troop needs, but also to have a procurement budget for experiments. SAS thinks this is a step in the right direction. At the same time, he warns that Europe and NATO at large are not doing enough.
Procurement is not adapting to the reality how fast this conflict is moving, which means that if you have still 2-3 years procurement cycles, there is a zero chance you capture the reality. Ukraine is so eager to share the learnings, said, hey, this didn't work out.
Like SAS, Ukrainian convoy driver Dennis believes that civilian efforts are also vital for EU countries trying to up their defense game. Dennis' volunteer organization, Social Drone, a decentralized network for drone production, as he calls it, is a case in point.
Our volunteers make drones and then we process them, we repair, we test them, and then we drive those drones to the front lines and we spend time with the soldiers because we need to understand what problems they have, how we can help them fix those.
Before the full-scale invasion, Dennis was a software developer in Kyiv and a hobby drone pilot. Feeling compelled to help the war effort, he switched from writing code to tinkering with drones full-time. Since then, according to Dennis, Social Drone has delivered more than 55,000 drones to the military in addition to publishing video tutorials teaching volunteers how to build the drones. But Dennis fears that red tape is hampering the adoption of this kind of DIY approach elsewhere in Europe.
I've spoken to many people from Europe who said that it's so difficult for them to innovate, especially because of the laws on flying drones. Europe countries should make it easier for regular people to just go out, fly, test drones, and not have to make like 10 papers with 50 stamps.
Another transferable lesson from Ukraine is that military strength isn't the only prerequisite to withstand and counter Russian aggression. In recent months and years, experts have increasingly pointed to societal resilience as another critical factor. They argue that EU countries need to invest much more in robust democratic institutions, psychological defense, and civil preparedness. More than that, an effective defense strategy needs a whole-of-society effort that includes civilian and military networks working in tandem, such as by integrating civilians on the front lines with mobile phones and prompting them to provide live surveillance and information to the military. An example of Estonian civil preparedness is the 30,000-member-strong Estonian Defense League, EDL, more than 4,000 of whose members have joined since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Activities of the volunteer organization, which is subordinate to the Estonian Defense Forces, include regular exercises, a drone training center, cyber defense, teaching school children survival skills, as well as supporting police and the Estonian Rescue Service Agency. The latter has developed a series of videos to prepare for situations like air raids. In case of a military conflict or a different crisis situation, Estonians can get concrete advice via the Ole Valmis Be Ready app. The Women's Voluntary Defense Organization, one of the EDL subgroups, has developed the app, which also offers information on stockpiling supplies, the disruption of vital services like power or water, as well as reporting tools for suspicious drones and hostile activities of a foreign country. Neeme Bruus is a reserve major in Kaitseliit, as the Defense League is called in Estonia. He says there has been a particular focus on preparing for drone warfare since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion.
It's quite interesting for younger people, especially in the schools. Classes started there already with drones because the young people, they already know how to fly drones. And of course, in the regular army, we have drone units already.
Over 60% of Estonian citizens are prepared to defend their country, according to a 2024 survey commissioned by the Defense Ministry. In contrast, only 16% of Germans say they are willing to do the same. Social Drone founder Dennis says a total defense approach requires readiness on all levels.
It's everyone's job. On individual level, each person should understand that they will have to play a role. The state should be saying the truth, that if something happens, you would have to also take part in defense. Because if enemy forces come to your town and there is no way to escape, there is no way around fighting or just dying like it was in Bucha or Irpin.
Convoy organizer Ragnar Sass remembers the Bucha massacre, where Russian forces tortured and killed hundreds of civilians in March 2022 with absolute horror.
What? That same road? It was parallel road where my wife and mom had lived.
Sass has had strong ties to Ukraine for well over a decade. But the main reason the atrocities hit close to home is that he's married to a Ukrainian who used to live in Bucha.
Horror. It's difficult to remove, and it's difficult to build this kind of filter. And I quite fast learned to just not look any photos, not look any videos, because humans who is getting killed. And it's difficult to disconnect from that.
Sass, who sold a startup for over $1 billion in 2020, has devoted almost his entire life to helping Ukraine win the war against Russia. Aside from the convoys, he organizes boot camps in Ukraine to teach startups from all over Europe how to sell to the military, understand the country's combat needs, and test technology live on the front line. Sass also puts on defense tech-themed meetups in Tallinn and invests in European startups with military applications, both part of a wider effort to rearm Europe, as he calls it.
The war is here. The war is in Europe. It's just Ukraine losing the best people at the moment. So we know that this is our war to be sure that Russia would never end up here. We cannot just, you know, say, oh, we are tired. These people in the front lines, they cannot be tired. They have lost their best friends, their best comrades, and so on. So there's no chance. We have to help Ukraine win so this war will end. The war can only end when Ukraine wins.
Ben Bartke, DW in Tallinn, Estonia.
A quick reminder of our feedback address here, insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
When headlines get louder,
we go deeper.
Say hello to Berlin Briefing,
your guide to Germany's impact on the world.
Between East and West, autocrats and democrats, Germany's whole system is under stress.
Pressure from all sides.
And the world around Germany is getting more dangerous.
Is democracy glitching? Too much noise? Too little clarity?
We decode what it means for you.
From Berlin to right where you are.
It's all in Berlin Briefing on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
87 years ago, on December 1st, 1938, the first of the so-called Kindertransport left Berlin, carrying 200 Jewish children to safety in England. Thousands of children were ultimately saved, although they were, of course, a small proportion of those murdered in the Holocaust. In the former Czechoslovakia, the rescue effort is commonly associated with one man, the late Sir Nicholas Winton. A group of descendants of Winton's children recently visited Prague, from where Rob Cameron reports.
Hello, Vera. And I should tell you that you are actually sitting next to Nicholas Winton.
Hello. The famous clip from the BBC TV show That's Life, showing Nicholas Winton confronted with a studio full of the children he'd helped save half a century earlier in 1939, now adults in their 60s and 70s.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please? Mr. Winton, would you like to turn round?
The oft-repeated claim that he'd kept the story secret for 50 years until the That's Life programme is something of an oversimplification. His late daughter, Barbara, claims that while the rescue efforts were little known to the wider public, he didn't deliberately hide them. The scheme to get the children out of Czechoslovakia is also sometimes painted inaccurately as a one-man operation. He was actually part of a wider network of Quakers, Jewish charities and socialists, something he was always at pains to stress. I was lucky enough to meet him on several occasions, the last time in 2011.
Nobody had done anything for the children because everybody said nobody in England is going to allow a whole lot of children into the country without their parents. And I've always worked on the principle that if something's not impossible, there must be a way of doing it.
Winton and his colleagues organised a total of 8 trains from Prague. A 9th, carrying 250 children, was due to leave on September 1st, 1939, but Germany's invasion of Poland intervened. The train never left, and the vast majority of children are believed to have perished. It's since been estimated that there are now thousands of people alive today because of the some 669 children that Nicholas Winton did manage to save, most of whom went on to have children of their own. They include Sarah Beck from London, whose 15-year-old father was on a Winton train that left Prague in July 1939.
For me, I knew absolutely nothing about my father's history until after he died. And then when we were clearing his study, we discovered a packet of letters that were just shoved into a filing cabinet. And they were letters from his, primarily from his mother, but some from his father, written to him in 1939 and through to 41, sent to him in England. We knew nothing. He never ever spoke about his past. He was always a very optimistic and happy man to us, but there were things that you never actually asked in our family. So we never knew to ask because we didn't know what those questions were.
But did you know anything about the fact that he'd fled Czechoslovakia as a child or anything about how he fled the Nazis?
No, nothing about our grandparents whatsoever. And to our knowledge, he'd come from Austria, not from Prague. We really were completely ignorant of it, which can sound ludicrous to people, but it actually is quite understandable that he never wanted to dwell on that at all.
Sarah was part of a tour of Prague and the former Theresienstadt concentration camp organised by the UK-based Association of Jewish Refugees, a charity founded in 1941 by Jews fleeing Nazi persecution in Europe. Joining Sarah was Mandy Gutwin, whose Czechoslovak father-in-law was put on a Winton train by his grandparents at the age of just 4.
My husband always knew that his father was a refugee, but he didn't really understand the significance of it, and the family didn't really talk very much about it. They were, I think, like your family, they were looking forwards rather than backwards. So they didn't want to dwell on it. And it wasn't until the That's Life programme where he didn't appear because he hadn't sort of identified himself as one of the children. And it was after that that the rest of the family started to ask more questions.
We were speaking on Wenceslas Square, just a few steps from the Alcron Hotel, which in 1938 served as a makeshift office for Doreen Warriner, head of the Prague branch of the British Committee for Refugees from Czechoslovakia. One of Doreen's colleagues in Prague was a man named Martin Blake, who had a stockbroker friend in London named Nicholas Winton. Blake had actually invited Winton to go skiing with him in Switzerland in the winter of 1938, but then he called him up on the telephone and said, "Forget the skis, I need you in Prague." And the rest, as they say, is history. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
This is Age is Just a Number, a series where we introduce young changemakers from across Europe.
I couldn't really stand by and just say, that's okay, we'll let inequalities be inequalities. I needed to make a difference.
Like when I started, you know, my whole project, I was like 21, 22 years old. People don't take you seriously.
You have to fight for your rights.
We try to preserve our language, our liturgy, our culture, our music and traditions.
From a youth parliamentarian and disability advocate to those pushing environmental and health equity issues, you'll learn what motivates them, how they got started, and what they want to do next.
We have collected until now more than 2 million kilograms of plastic from the Mediterranean Sea.
I created the website for people to feel seen, heard and respected within medicine, in particular for black and brown communities.
When I was a child, I was just told I wouldn't live beyond the age of 6, and I'm 25 right now, so happy to be here.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Coming up in the next half hour, Balkans briefing. Two stories from a region with a violent past and an uncertain future. Then, fast fashion or woolly jumpers. We look at France's battle with the Chinese retail giant Shein and why the fate of Mediterranean woolens may lie in the hands of artisanal cheesemakers. We'll be untangling all those threads here on Inside Europe. To the Balkans first, to Republika Srpska, an unusual political entity that grew out of the violent dissolution of Yugoslavia. It's independent in some ways, but also part of the larger country that is Bosnia and Herzegovina. Republika Srpska has just held snap presidential elections. They were called in the wake of the ouster of former President Milorad Dodik earlier this year. In February, Dodik was barred from all political activity for 6 years and received a suspended prison sentence for disregarding decisions made by the High Representative who oversees the implementation of the Dayton Peace Agreement in the region, and also for pursuing policies rooted in pro-Serb separatism. The winner of the elections, although the results are disputed by the opposition, more on that later, is a man named Siniša Karan. Nevertheless, I put it to our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay that the actual winner is really a man whose name did not even appear on the ballot.
I think it would be fair to say that Milorad Dodik, the man who was barred from holding the office of President of Republika Srpska and indeed any other public office in Bosnia and Herzegovina, was indeed the victor. And his name, as you say, wasn't on the ballot, but it was on all the campaign posters. Because if you were going around in Republika Srpska, which is the majority Serb region of Bosnia and Herzegovina, you'd have seen these posters saying, for Srpska, for Karan, for Dodik. And it would have a picture there of Milorad Dodik looming over Siniša Karan, who was the actual candidate, and making it quite clear that a vote for Karan was a vote for Dodik. And indeed, after the election, Milorad Dodik took to the platform of his SNSD party, which was having a nice little victory party, and said, you've got two Dodiks now. So that's interesting news for Republika Srpska, one would say.
Now, the opposition guy, they are rejecting the result, claims that the election was not free and fair. What can we say about that? Was this a free and fair election?
Well, we have heard from the OSCE monitors. Now, these are the international monitors that combine with the European Union as well. And they have the acronym ODHR, which they actually pronounce, it sounds like ODIA when they pronounce it, but they are the international monitors. And they said there were problems with the election, but they were primarily about access to media. And this is what we often hear in this region. You'll hear it in Serbia as well, for example, that the governing party has much better access to media than any of the opposition parties or candidates. And that created, as the OSCE observers said, this playing field which was not level in those sort of terms. But are we talking about massive amounts of ballot stuffing, electoral fraud? That wasn't an indication which was given by the international monitors after the election.
Irregularities or no, one rather concerning development was the historically low turnout. Under 35% of people voted.
Yeah, it's a very low turnout. And when you consider that 3 years ago, during the elections then, there was a turnout of 53%, you can see there's a fairly dramatic fall in terms of the number of people who made their way to the polling stations. You can draw some conclusions from this. You'd have to talk to individuals, of course, and maybe do a proper survey. But the conclusions one would obviously draw from this was there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for this election. And that means there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm either for Sinisha Karan, who was the winning candidate and basically standing in as a proxy for Milorad Dodik, or for the main opposition candidate, Branko Blanusha, who the opposition had put forward. They'd united many of the opposition parties and put forward Branko Blanusha, who was a not very high-profile academic, and they put him forward, if you like, as a clean skin. And his slogan was, "Make Srpska proud again." It wasn't really perhaps the most helpful slogan, but he was talking about corruption and the issues of corruption in Republika Srpska and what he would do about that. Well, clearly that's not a message that's convinced the electorate.
I'd just like to pick up on something that you said. You were talking about concerns about access to media. Russia is a country with interests in the region. One pattern that we see repeated is concern over Russian influence in terms of media output. Was this a concern in this election?
It's always a concern. And the question is, to what degree is Russia influencing media, not just in Bosnia and Herzegovina, but other parts of the Western Balkans as well? They certainly have their official output, if you like, with Sputnik and RT, which have operations in the region. But then there are stories, which again are very hard to substantiate, about the individual media outlets receiving incentives, shall we say, from Russia to take particular editorial lines. I mean, plenty of the outlets anyway are picking up copy from RT and Sputnik and running with it because, of course, like any media outlets, they're short on money, they're short on personnel, and if they've got somebody else producing material which they can republish, they're very delighted to do that. So that's why these operations of RT and Sputnik in the Western Balkans do have an influence. The thing is as well, Mr. Dodik has always made a very big deal about his connections with Russia. He's constantly popping over to Moscow or St. Petersburg and posing for photographs with Vladimir Putin. So that's always been standing there. And one always has to ask, what's in it for Russia in terms of running any sort of editorial interference or particular lines in the media? Well, it's simply a way of keeping things unstable at a very low cost to Russia, but it's a higher cost when it comes to the larger European picture. If you've got instability in the Western Balkans, that's something else that the European countries need to worry about, which they would rather hope they didn't have to at this point.
Mm. Is instability then the key takeaway really this week from those election results?
I think the key takeaway, if you're really going to go high level and big picture, is that the voters in Republika Srpska and more widely the population of Bosnia and Herzegovina is thoroughly fed up. It's now 30 years since the Dayton Peace Agreement, which split Bosnia into these two so-called entities, with Republika Srpska and the majority of Serbs in one half of the country, and the Federation with most of the Bosniaks and Croats in the other half. And it simply isn't working well in terms of it being a functioning country, because you have these ethno-nationalist politicians or politicians who pose as being ethno-nationalists, like Milorad Dodik does, and they have a modus operandi which is simple. They divide, they rule, and they profit. So that's the big picture, really, that 30 years on from the Dayton Peace Agreement, you've got a country which isn't at war, but it's not exactly prosperous and moving forward either.
I'm going to be really annoying and zoom out even further because, I mean, the absolute macro picture, you know, if we were to sort of look down at the Balkans region, what is the significance of what happens in Republika Srpska to the region as a whole?
It's got a knock-on effect in many respects. If things are going sideways in Republika Srpska and they're talking about secession there, what does that say about Kosovo? What does it say for other parts of the Western Balkans, for example, parts of North Macedonia, which are majority Albanian? Are we then looking at secessionist movements there? Because we did, of course, have an extremely nasty conflict there in 2001. All of this is at play in the Western Balkans, and Republika Srpska is one part of that. And the challenge for not just people in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and not just in the Western Balkans, but in the wider European community, is making sure that those rumblings don't turn into something louder, which does indeed destabilise this entire region.
Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay there. You can follow Guy on Blue Sky for all the latest Balkans insights. That's what I do. Staying in the Balkans region now, we move to Montenegro. At the end of last month, protests made a little talked of phenomenon suddenly visible. Anti-Turkish sentiment set against the backdrop of Turkey's increased economic interest in a region which was once part of the Ottoman Empire. Our Istanbul correspondent, Dorian Jones, has taken a closer look at Turkey's Balkans ambitions and the powerful feathers they seem to be ruffling.
Turks out, shout protesters as they march through the streets of the capital of Montenegro. Many Turkish businesses, which are among the largest investors in the Balkan state, were ransacked and looted. The unrest erupted after two Turks were arrested in connection with a knife attack on a Montenegrin, although both were subsequently cleared by a Montenegro court. The Montenegro government imposed visa requirements on Turkish visitors. But some opposition parties and Muslim leaders in Montenegro are accusing neighbouring Serbia of being behind the unrest by inciting the country's large Serbian minority. The protests come amid rising Serbian-Turkish tensions. Vuk Vuksanovic of the Belgrade Centre for Security Policy says inciting anti-Turk protests in Montenegro is well within Belgrade's capabilities.
Serbia has more influence probably than even frequently touted players like Russia, for that matter. I think it is probably more accurate to speak about Serbian rather than Russian influence in Montenegro. Although I have seen no material evidence, this drama involving Montenegro does build up to this difficult atmospherics in Serbo-Turkish relations nevertheless.
Predominantly Muslim Kosovo seceded from Serbia in 1999 after a bloody conflict. In earlier centuries, however, the region fell under Ottoman control, and present-day ties between Kosovo and Turkey remained strong. Last month, the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, accused Ankara of seeking to resurrect the Ottoman Empire following the sale of sophisticated military drones to Kosovo, which Belgrade considers as part of Serbia. Security expert Zoran Ivanov at the Institute of National History in Skopje in Macedonia says the drone sale is a potential game changer.
So these are the kamikaze drones, so which is mean the posing a threat, and also these strategic drones likely to use to secure the border itself and more as a use of show of force. So it also pose a direct threat, security threat to Serbia. Serbia has to react this.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is, as so often, performing a delicate political balancing act. While developing ties with Pristina, he also seeks to maintain close relations with his Serbian counterpart, Aleksandar Vučić. Turkish companies are among the most prominent investors in Serbia. However, the arms sale to Kosovo is a sign of Ankara's growing ambitions in the Balkans and its confidence. International relations professor Hussein Barca of Ankara's Middle East Technical University.
The Ottoman Empire was a Balkan empire. Millions of people who emigrated from there to Turkey. The relations are very strong, and I understand the Serbs, the Bulgarians, even Albanians, that the Turkish influence is getting bigger, increasing, and of course they don't like it. But Turkey is the big brother in the Balkans.
Another sign of Turkey's influence over the Balkans, a military ceremony in October to mark Turkish forces' assumption of the leadership of NATO's K4 peacekeeping operations in Kosovo. At the same time, Turkish businesses continue to expand across the region. But Balkan security expert Ivanov warns that Turkey's growing influence coincides with increasing nationalism in the region.
They're expanding their markets, they're expanding their capabilities, they're expanding their their influence. That's natural for the Turks to come to invest in the region, and now they're looking for their old roots. But also for us, as a man who is coming from the Balkans, right, to see the Turks, okay, Turks are coming, you know, as they were, you know, in the history. So these nationalistic rhetorics are growing as much as they can, you know, and they're boiling from inside. And something boils, you know, it's a matter of time when they will come up out of the pot.
The European Union has praised Ankara for its support of peacekeeping operations and economic assistance in Kosovo, as well as its broader role in efforts to mitigate tensions. However, Vuk Vuksanovic warns that with Turkey's growing Balkan ambitions, Ankara needs to tread carefully in an increasingly volatile region.
Ankara also has to be mindful of its own limitations of its own Balkan ambitions, because otherwise it can push majority Christian Orthodox nations like Serbs, Greece and Bulgarians to work against the Turks if Turkey is perceived as being too provocative and aggressive.
The anti-Turk protests quickly subsided in Montenegro. However, whether they will be the last in the Balkans will likely depend on how well Ankara pursues its regional goals, which could threaten to stoke historical tensions in a region where history is invariably never far from the present. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
If you're interested in finding out more about the Balkans, then there are a whole host of fascinating explainer articles on DW's Europe pages. For now, though, we're going to swap political machinations in the Balkans for all the sparkle and glitz of a busy Parisian shopping street just before Black Friday. Only, you guessed it, there's a catch. The Chinese ultra-fast fashion retailer Shein has recently taken up residence on the sixth floor of Paris's historic BHV department store, which is right opposite Paris's City Hall. And its presence there is, shall we say, controversial. This report from John Lawrenson.
Black Friday. For many people opposed to the opening of the Shein store in Paris, the term, for once, is a suitable one. These are dark days. Over the couple of weeks that it's been open, Parisians have been showing that while their city is this... The opening of Shein's first permanent physical retail location in the world, in a prestigious department store a stone's throw from Paris City Hall, it is also this. Fired up by the shock revelation that sex dolls with the appearance of a young girl holding a teddy bear had been for sale on the Singapore-based site, protesters mingled with queuing shoppers in front of the BHV department store. This one, reacting to allegations of forced labour, child labour, low wages and excessive working hours among Shein's thousands of suppliers, mainly in China but also in India, Brazil and Turkey, said, "I've been a customer of BHV for years. It's shameful. I want people to realise that it's completely abnormal for this brand to settle in Paris physically. The way they compete, the way they manufacture, nothing they do conforms to our regulations." But many others formed long lines in the hope of a bargain. Yes, it's controversial, but in that case, all stores are controversial, said this woman. Because when you look closely, so much comes from China. Here, though, when you look at the prices, nothing else in France comes near.
Le gouvernement engage la procédure de suspension de chaîne.
In the wake of the sex doll scandal, the Minister for Small Businesses, Serge Papin, told the National Assembly that he'd been instructed by the Prime Minister to start suspension proceedings against Shein while he said the Chinese company was adjusting to French laws. France wants a three-month suspension. A hearing in that case has been postponed to December the 5th. Even before the Paris shop opening, the French authorities had taken several actions against the Chinese fast fashion retailer, fining Shein, for example, for nearly €200 million for various consumer protection violations. There's now a draft anti-fast fashion law, which, if finally adopted, will impose a surcharge of €5 on each item sold to offset the environmental cost. As for Paris Deputy Mayor for Sustainability Patrick Bloch, he said that Paris City Hall had declared war on Shein and BHV. It represents ultra-fast fashion, he said, which betrays Paris's values. One measure it's taken is to forbid BHV from hosting outdoor Christmas events. Meanwhile, some of the standard bearers of Paris as a centre for high quality, highly durable, high fashion also protested against Shein's implantation at BHV by withdrawing from the store. Brands like Chanel and Dior will no longer sell their clothing there, which is bound to affect sales at the department store. But Frédéric Merlin, CEO of SGM, the company that owns BHV, is not concerned. He believes that the increase in traffic thanks to Shein will easily compensate any losses elsewhere.
Je pense qu'il y a un tapage médiatique.
I think there's an irrational media and political outburst around the Shein affair, Merlin said. Shein is 1,000 square metres in a building that is 50,000 square metres. It's a popular success. We welcome between 8,000 and 10,000 people every day who have come specially for Shein. Whatever the outcome of the battle in France, the signs are that it may take a while for the model to spread. Reacting to the backlash, BHV's parent company has announced that the opening of new Shein stores in Dijon, Grenoble, Reims, Limoges and Angers have been put on hold. Meanwhile, as of Black Friday, there are 26 shopping days left to Christmas. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
The big unanswered question, of course, is where is John Lawrenson going to buy his Christmas socks? Answers on a postcard or Inside Europe at dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. It's not just Parisian haute couture that's being threatened by the advent of ultra-fast fashion. Traditional homespun, and yes, the pun was intended, industries are feeling the pinch too. Take wool, for example. For generations, a trusty European staple, and yet, with the rise and rise of cheap synthetic materials, wool is being pushed out. The knock-on effect has been that wool has gone from being a valuable resource to a cost-incurring waste byproduct for cheese and meat-producing sheep farmers. So, what can be done for wool to return to being a benefit and not a burden? Sounds like a case for that champion of all things artisanal, our reporter, Danny Mitzman.
Pungent and perfect on a cracker with a dollop of marmalade, Pecorino's Italy's most popular sheep's milk cheese. The most famous variety comes from the island of Sardinia, which, no coincidence, has its own Razza Sarda breed of sheep. While cheese and meat have always been the primary resource for Italy's shepherds, wool was, until not long ago, a valuable byproduct.
In passato la lana era una risorsa importantissima.
Slow Foods' Raffaella Ponzio says wool in the Abruzzo region historically made sheep farming families enough money to put their children through school.
Questo dà l'idea di quanto fosse importante economicamente questa risorsa.
But today the situation's very different.
Negli ultimi anni è diventato una cosa più che una risorsa.
Tuscan Pecorino producer Angela Saba says wool's now so devalued, selling it doesn't even cover their sheep shearing costs.
Che non una risorsa.
And she says wool's declining popularity in the clothing sector is only a part of the problem. In Europe, wool's classed as special waste, meaning it has to be washed in specific scouring plants. Over the past decade, they've been closing down, and now there's just one left in Italy.
Preferisco stoccarla, tenerla lì,
Angela says she'd rather keep her wool than give it to people who take it to, say, North Africa, wash it much more cheaply, then sell it back to us at a much higher cost. Instead, she stocks it and turns it into fertilizer, which she says works a treat. Fertilizer is one of the innovations being studied by a European project led by Italy's National Research Council, looking at ways to protect the future of Mediterranean wool. Covering Italy, Corsica and the south of France, the project's called Marlène, mar as in the Italian for sea, len as in the French for wool.
My name is Chiara Spigarelli, I'm a founder of Agrivello, a startup that can convert wool in fertilizer.
Chiara's been speaking at the General Assembly of Wool, a conference Marlène's organized together with Slow Food.
The problem is washing wool. So with the fertilizer, we can make the circular economy without the washing, without the washing process, because with the fertilizer, it's not important to wash it.
Having studied wool's potential for her PhD, Chiara decided to turn theory into commercial reality. She's become the only producer in Italy transforming wool, which is nitrogen-rich and highly hygroscopic, into fertilizer pellets.
It's not nitrogen made from lab or synthetic industry. It's an organic product and the best natural product to fertilize.
Her slow-release pellets allow farmers and gardeners to fertilise just once every 5 months. Currently only in northern Italy, she hopes they'll soon be collecting and converting wool from sheep farmers throughout the country and other parts of Europe. But there are also people here who believe that with a bit of creative thinking, wool can still recover its textile value. Giuseppe De Melis' mother started their family business Maria Antonia Urru in 1981, collecting wool from local shepherds in their native Sardinia and transforming it into thread to make carpets and soft furnishings. He says exploring new uses for wool is part of their evolution. Giuseppe's family business today creates bespoke furnishings and wall panels for hotels and resorts. They also work with designer bag and bed manufacturers, and their most recent new venture is in the car sector, in collaboration with Toyota. Over the next 3 years, Toyota's planning to replace polyurethane foam entirely with natural materials, and their seat prototype, made of 100% Sardinian wool, is one of those being considered. Whether it's for textiles or fertilizer, insulation or cosmetics, the real sticking point people here are keen to address is wool's European classification as special waste. Marlène and Slow Food are advocating to get it declassified to ordinary waste and for the reopening of small-scale scouring plants to be permitted.
Allora, sicuramente occorre prevedere una normativa diversa.
The irony, according to Raffaella, being that industrial wool scouring is itself very polluting because it uses solvents and a lot of water.
Con costi e con passaggi complessi.
So does Mediterranean wool have a future? Yes, thinks Raffaella, if farmers, shepherds and cheesemakers continue to protect and support local breeds and ensure that flocks graze in clear, accessible pastures. That way there'll be high-quality wool available in various thicknesses. And then it's down to us to be responsible consumers by choosing wool over petroleum-derived synthetic fibres. Because a healthy coat for a sheep is a healthy coat for us. Danny Mitzman for DW in Italy.
And Danny Mitzman's woolly yarn brings us to the end of the show. This programme was produced by Laura Kaberka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineering team was Navina Boot and Christian Steter. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.